for June 6th. I'm going to start over again, apparently. I was like, geez, 5th or 6th? This is the Drupal Easy Podcast, episode 59 for June 6th, 2011. Hello and welcome to Drupal Easy Podcast. I am your host for today, Ryan Price, and we have some of our regular cast of characters, but in a different location. Sounding a slightly more Dutch today is Mike Lonello.
Hello, Mr. Price.
Mike, are you beautifully settled into your summer home, as it were?
I'm feeling, yeah, it's very overcast today, and we had some rain, so it was like the first day of rain since we arrived, but it's hard to complain.
Yeah. So for those of you who did not listen to the podcasts since about a year ago, you'll know that Mike's family has a home in Belgium, in Antwerp, and that's where you are right now. You go for a couple of weeks out of the summer.
Yeah. It's we're very fortunate.
And are you going to be hanging out with Crimson any of them while you're there?
Yeah, I've already touched base with those guys, and they're kind enough to kind of let me desk surf as I need it. And yeah, they've got a bunch of big brains over there. They're like
very
the
cool.
Display suite kings.
So we have a lot of great stories to get to today. But before we do that, I'd like to introduce our special guest, who many of you may know. It's Matt Butcher. And just to give a little bit of intro to Matt, he's one of the co-authors of a recent book, Drupal 7 Module Development by Pact Publishing. He currently works for a company called ConsumerSearch.com, which is, and this is the official phrase, part of About.com, a New York Times company. Is that right, Matt?
That is right.
Are we allowed to say ConsumerSearch.com without saying
yes,
part
yes.
of About.com, a New York Times company?
As long as you've said it once, I think it should cover it for the whole
All right,
whole
we're good then. We're good.
And I guess Matt actually was a guest of ours before. Mike, was that just like an individual interview?
Yeah, I think I interviewed Matt. It was just me when the Drupal 6 jQuery and JavaScript book. Is that right, Matt?
That's right, yeah.
That sounds right, yeah. Which is, you know, still a great book to learn JavaScript and Drupal.
You know, that's also a really interesting indicator. That episode came out almost exactly 2 years ago.
Oh, within 3 days. Look at that.
Yeah,
wow.
So we've been doing this for a while, I guess.
So, Matt,
you guys,
we will...
You guys didn't plan that?
We can... we'll pin you in for June 3rd of 2013 right now.
Wow, we are nerds. Okay, so the last thing I want to say about Matt is that... Recognize him also from his blog and his accounts on the internet, Techno Sophos, which is spelled in a very Greek sort of a manner. Is there some inspiration behind that, Matt?
Oh, yeah, it's geeky, as you would suppose. You know, techne is kind of the Greek word for, you know, working with your hands or craftsmanship or something like that. And then sophos, of course, is wisdom. And I just always thought that was kind of evocative of what it takes to be a good software developer. So
this is awesome. Like, I'm on the pitcher's mound, I got the softball, and then you just hit it out.
That was a nice pitch.
I had no idea that it was going to be that precise, but that's great. So, Matt, we have you on the podcast today, and you are the first of our five stories. Every other week, whenever we get together and do this, we're trying to do every other week. We're trying to do Mondays, so normally this will come out on a Monday or a Tuesday throughout the week. That's at least our plan for the summer. We'll see what happens after we hit DrupalCon. But I'm just rambling now. So the idea is we try to do five stories that we found on Drupal Planet or maybe somewhere else on the internet and to try to condense all of the Drupal news that's happening out there. And there seems to be more and more and more all the time, but we just want to pick five things. And our first thing today is actually talking a little bit about Matt's book and his contributions to the Drupal community. So, Matt, you have a new book coming out. Why don't you give us an idea of who the audience is for this book and sort of what problem it's trying to solve for them.
I'm going to interrupt Matt because I think Matt's head might explode because you keep on calling it his book. And there are many other authors that are probably... Although, despite the fact that Matt told us to refer to it as his book, I don't think we're doing the other people justice. I think we should mention their names.
Yeah, because I co-wrote this book with Matt Farina and Ken Rickard and Greg Dunlap and Larry Garfield and John Albin Wilkins. And then, of course, one of my Summer of Code students, Sivaji, was one of the technical reviewers to it. And Sam Boyer was one of the original authors, and his Git migration got in the way of him finishing. So really, there were a lot of people involved in doing this book.
This is like an all-star team.
It was, yeah.
I mean, it really, really is. I mean, well, I'm going to let you say it rather than me. I think that's more interesting.
Okay. The story behind it was, I wrote Learning Drupal 6 Module Development right around the time Drupal 6 came out. And it was fun to do, but over and over as I wrote the book, I thought, I can only scratch the surface of this stuff. You just can't know all of Drupal anymore. One person can't contain the whole thing in their head at any given time anymore. And so when the opportunity came up to do a revised and expanded version, I went, well, I don't know if I can do this myself. So I started talking to others. Most of us worked at Palantir at the time. And we kind of outlined a book and submitted that back to Pact. And Pact was really enthusiastic about it. And that was kind of how we got started. The idea was to kind of update the Learning Drupal 6 book and provide something that explained to a developer or to a programmer how to dive into Drupal and work with all of these Drupalisms and get going creating modules. And of course, with Drupal 7, there were so many new things that we ended up focusing or kind of trying to split it up and do sort of a dual focus. On one hand, we wanted to introduce developers to Drupal. And on the other hand, we wanted to help existing developers kind of get kickstarted on their Drupal 7 development, jump from Drupal 6 to Drupal 7. So that was the goal.
So can you go through, I mean, it's kind of easy. If you're familiar with the Drupal community, we know that, Larry Garfield he's a database guy. John Wilkins is a theming guy. But so I'm assuming that those guys contributed those portions of the book. Can you kind of go through and talk about who wrote what portions and like where everyone's strengths lies? Because I think that's kind of very telling.
Yeah, the original intent was, well, actually the way we did it was we kind of broke out the chapters and divvied them up amongst us and then peer-reviewed each other's work. And then, of course, we had these excellent technical reviewers who did more peer review on the book. So since I, of course, wanted to take on the biggest challenge and all of that, I wrote the introductory chapter in chapter two. And then, yeah, not really a heavy brain power involved there. But then, yeah, like you said, John wrote the chapters on theming and the entity and field stuff was done by Larry. Also, I think he did the security and database appendices too.
Oh, wow.
He wrote the Drupal 7 database layer and has been, as you know, he's heading up the Butler stuff now. He's very into the entities and field stuff and knows that inside and out at this point. Now I get hazy and I have to remember who did everything. I'm pretty sure Ken did the permissions and node access where Ken Rickard's been involved.
That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And Matt Farina did the JavaScript work.
I would have guessed that would have been you.
Well, I learned a lot from Matt about that kind of stuff. He's a very, very good JavaScript developer and has lots of connections in the community. So we probably either of us could have done something like that, but I think Matt's knowledge is probably deeper than mine. So he did an excellent job. And then I think that Greg Dunlap wrote the files and images chapters and maybe the installation profile chapter. And Greg now is heading up the core initiative for configuration management and deployment and that sort of thing.
As I went through the book over the weekend, and the theming chapters, the early in the book, I want to say chapters 2 and 3 or 3 and 4, something like that.
Yeah.
And the first of the two is really just it dives deep and quickly and gives a really, really good overview of theming in Drupal 7. It was like, I learned a lot in just in that one chapter.
And many of the chapters are like that. Of course, the entities chapter is probably one of the hardest because it was such a new concept. And poor Larry. I mean, we started this book before even RC1 had come out. And that API was probably the most influx of any of the Drupal 7 APIs up until the final code freeze. I think you must have rewritten that chapter like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, that was the next one on my list of ones to bring up, is that chapter. Because what it does is it really gives a nice overview of, you know, not only what an entity is, but why we needed them. And it cleared up a lot of like little gray areas here and there for me. And it's one of those chapters that, in all honesty, not a whole lot of people are ever going to need. People building the vast majority of Drupal sites with CCK and whatever, they're not going to need to create a new entity. But to have this chapter as like just a solid reference on the thinking behind what an entity is, what it means, it's just such a valuable asset to the community.
Yeah. And Larry really beat everyone out of the gate on that. I'm not even sure any of the other books on the market cover it. And Larry could do it because, of course, he's been highly involved in Drupal for many years and also had the tenacity to rewrite that chapter over and over again.
The other chapter in there I really enjoyed was it kind of goes through the process of creating a new field type from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. Which is something, you know, a lot more developers end up having to do, custom field types. But this was just a really nice walkthrough of all of the various hooks that are involved. You know, how do you put it together? Just top to bottom. It's just a really good chapter for people who were, you know, familiar with how to do it in Drupal 6 or people who have always had a need for it. I mean, this chapter really just says, here's a step-by-step almost.
And the good that one in particular, good solid but easy to read code samples that you could just kind of follow through and
so,
get going.
What chapters that you didn't write did you find to be like the most, you know, the most valuable or like the most eye opening?
Can I say anything about that? Boy, I mean, the crazy thing about doing this is, you know, I've worked on Drupal now for years. I worked at Palantir, did dozens of sites. I work now with the Consumer Search Group and do, you know, one of these monstrously large Drupal sites. And yet still, probably every single chapter I learned something. I even learned stuff about my own material from the peer reviewers who pointed out things that had changed in Drupal 7 that I didn't even know. So as far as learning goes, I don't think there was a section that I didn't learn at least a little bit from. The entities stuff, of course, was probably the one where I learned the most the fastest. Mm-hmm. Because like everyone else out there, I didn't have the time to dedicate to following the development of the code. So I was really enthusiastic about that one. But really, it was a learning experience for me.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the JavaScript chapters. I'm not, you know, not a JavaScript guru by any sense, but I've done my fair share of, you know, Ajax things in Drupal with JavaScript. And the one big thing I learned was the JavaScript hook library integration, which was new for Drupal 7, and I had never like even read about it anywhere else until I went through the book.
Yeah, you know, that's another one, and Matt did a really good job of that, of kind of finding some new features in Drupal that in the JavaScript layer that other people haven't been talking about much yet, because it's JavaScript's kind of a funny one. We're so PHP heavy as far as expertise goes, and then there's a relatively small number of Drupal developers who really, really actively contribute to the JavaScript portion, comparatively small. And so a lot of these kind of cool features go unnoticed until someone like Matt comes along and says, oh, look at this, and look at what you can do with it, and look at how this is going to make your life easier, and things like that. So,
yeah, those, I don't know if it was one or two chapters on JavaScript in the book, but they were very, I know the JavaScript behaviors are something that trip people up a lot and don't get used sometimes when it's very easy to use them and you get a lot of benefit out of out of writing something as a behavior.
Yeah.
But he did a really good job. As did you. That was the one big thing I learned from your jQuery book a couple of years ago, was really understanding JavaScript behaviors. And, you know, Matt does a fine job as well, kind of explaining and going through.
Yeah, he does.
Are you familiar or involved at all with the effort right now to kind of clean up Drupal's JavaScript and kind of, you know, push it forward and make it a little more modern?
Yeah, I mean, I know Matt Farina and I talk probably several times a week still, and he's been pretty active in that, and so he's been keeping me updated. JavaScript is something that I've strayed away from a little bit because the problems I've been solving are on the other end. I've been doing a lot of high performance stuff.
Okay.
But I say on the other end, and then Matt Farina would say, no, you know, if you really want to speed things up, JavaScript and CSS are good places to start. But anyway, yeah, I've been kind of following the work that team has been doing, and reading up, doing some background reading from people like Douglas Crockford, who have so much stuff, Nathan Smith, so much good stuff about how to really make JavaScript what you want and do it in a performant way.
Excellent. Now, I know Ryan and I'm pretty sure, Ryan, we talked about this article. It was, I don't know if it's about a year ago. I should pop it open, look at the date here, that you wrote, Matt, about why object-oriented programming is bad for Drupal. And Ryan, did we talk about this, Ryan, at some point? I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast. I don't think we have. Or maybe we did.
This might have been while we were in a little bit of a dry spell, so...
Yeah, so
it's definitely something that I've looked at before.
Yeah, so it's from October of last year.
Yeah.
This is a classic argument in the larger computer programming world, particularly people who write PHP, and they come to Drupal and they say, it doesn't do this, and it doesn't do this, and it doesn't do this, and a lot of those it doesn't do this have something to do with the object-oriented ideas, right?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because my background was Java programming. So, you know, I learned PHP as, I don't know, a seventh or eighth language after I'd done Java programming for 10 years, I think, by that point. And so I had to unlearn my OO stuff in order to really dive into Drupal the first time. And then, you know, you discover the elegance of Drupal's method of calling hooks and things like that, building up basically a very intuitive and productive procedural library. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how else to say that. There's probably a much simpler way to say that. It works right, you know?
Yeah.
It just felt like once I realized I don't need to declare classes, I don't need to declare methods and things like that, I need to start focusing on writing functions and in understanding and utilizing this hook system. And I liked that a lot once I kind of got the hang of it. What I also learned was that a lot of people came from a very strict procedural background and had once classes and objects started getting mixed back into Drupal, it was causing a lot of confusion. And of course, the APIs were getting even confusing for me because I was having a hard time remembering in what contexts or not even remembering, but figuring out in what context I should start writing OO Drupal and in what context I should remain with more procedural code. Uh-huh. And I talked to a lot of people I think I probably started talking to people around 2008 about this because, of course, you know, people like Larry Garfield are, like me, strongly OO in their background, and people like Chex are strongly procedural in their background, or at least Chex prefers procedural code. I think he understands OO way better than anybody ever thought he did when he first argued against it. And so you have these kind of two polarized camps. And on one hand, it sort of looks like we're having a kind of peaceful merging of the two. But on the other, there's still a whole bunch of frustrating, slightly below the surface conundrums that I'm going, we can't have everything all at once. And so at some point, I just kind of felt frustrated. And I sat down and started writing about why I thought that we were heading for a train wreck if we just kept trying to blend everything we liked about every different style into one platform. And that's where that blog post came from. And with Drupal 8, of course, you probably have seen how much the blending of styles has permeated the architecture for Drupal 8. The current services project and even some of the current configuration code really leaning toward the OO side. Yeah, so you know, the long and short of it was I wanted to write this article explaining how, even coming from my OO background, I found the whole notion of the Drupal embraces everything approach to programming to be a kind of a potential for real frustration and confusion with developers, you know, of course, seasoned developers, but also even the new developers. And Drupal has thousands of modules because we've always been able to bring in so many new developers. And so I kind of vented there, and that was my frustration blog.
Yeah, that was
a lot of feedback on it.
Well, that was the part of the post that kind of really, you know, I kind of took to. And I said, you know, that's a really good point, because when I started learning Drupal, you know, I knew PHP, but you know, by looking at Drupal's code, I learned a lot more PHP and a lot, you know, how to do it a little more elegantly. But even now, when I, you know, I've written a few custom views plugins, and those are all, you know, OO based, and it's a struggle for me to kind of follow what's going on and make sure I'm inheriting the right stuff. And it's definitely, like you said in your post, it's setting the bar higher for new developers to get involved. And that could potentially be bad.
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, new PHP developers. It's confusing for experienced OO developers to come in and say, well, okay, I know how this part works, but I'm not sure what this part is, and I don't know how they work together or blend. You know, it just ends up, I think, being confusing for anyone who didn't grow up inside of this ecosystem.
Right, so we'll put the link in the show notes. You know, this is right after that post came out. We probably should have had you on, because it's really, really interesting. I don't want to go too deep into it, you know, but the link will be in the show notes for anyone who's interested.
So, Mike, you have a story about basically some of the plans for now. We have essentially three versions of Drupal that are out there. You have Drupal 6 that is in active support. Drupal 7, which everyone hopefully is starting to use now, and Drupal 8, which is starting to get developed and add new features. And you know, every podcast, it seems we got some new Drupal 8 announcement yet, even though we probably won't be seeing and using Drupal 8 for another year or two. So this is news around that, right?
Yeah, this one's it's more of just procedural news. I thought it was interesting just because it's kind of showing that the Drupal community is maturing a little bit more. And so what Dries did was he announced that Webchick, Andy Byron, is going to have commit rights for Drupal 8 bug fixes. And there's a whole big issue on Drupal.org, and I'll put the link in the show notes. It's fascinating. I had no idea this whole discussion was even going on. Where when there's an issue found in Drupal 7 or in Drupal 6, you know, it gets fixed one place, but it needs to be fixed everywhere. It needs to be fixed in 8 and 7 and 6 and possibly 5. And what's the process for doing all that? So what Dries did and what the community has done is they've kind of decided on a process where when a bug is found, it first gets fixed in the latest version, which in this case would be Drupal 8. And then it gets backported to Drupal 7 and, if necessary, to Drupal 6. So what Dries did is he has given Angie the permission to commit bug fixes to Drupal 8. So he's not the only one who can do it, so he's not kind of the weak link. Weak link's probably not the right word, but if things need to happen and Dries is busy, there's now someone else can kind of fill that role. And the other interesting thing is they are developing a schedule for point releases for Drupal 7. And I believe it's going to be at around the end of every month. If there are security updates that need to be done, there will be a new release towards the end of each month. So it's nothing super exciting, but it's more procedural. But it's always good to see like processes put into place to better the community and the code.
Well, and we always have, you know, the sort of like bigger story of Drupal is how you know, bigger companies and different kinds of development shops are starting to support Drupal now. And if they could predict that by the end of the month there may be a new release of Drupal, that might affect when you launch a project or when you plan to do your, you know, upkeep on a project. You could kind of say, well, we expect there to be something to come out near the end of the month, so let's plan our, you know, our updates for that time.
Yeah, the yeah. the issue on Drupal.org, and I will put the link in the show notes, is up to 147 comments. So there's been a lot of discussion about this.
So. Yeah, and I know from the, you know, from the point of view of consumer search, we have a highly scheduled we already know what we're going to be doing through the end of this year and probably first quarter of next year. It was always sort of a shock when a new version of Drupal came out and we all kind of had to scramble and go, okay, yeah. One came out this week, we need to figure out what to do about it. And all too often the result has been, well, we do nothing about it until we have a gap in our workflow.
Right.
So it's a big move for us to go to something more formal.
Yeah,
and, you know, and Gabor did an excellent job of keeping Drupal 6 up to date.
Mm-hmm.
And but he also did it very quietly. And so it was when Drupal 7 came out, it's easy to see how we went, what was it, 2 or 3 months with no bug fixes, just because there was no out loud process for how we were going to do it. So this is good stuff.
Yeah, I think, like you said, especially big companies that have plans going out many months, this is definitely going to help. And it's probably been pushed along by, you know, some people involved with that.
Sure, sure. So... next story is actually one that I picked out, and this is a new one from our friends in Sweden, Johan Hazen. He has actually put out a video, so I'm just going to go through sort of the summary of points in the video here. The announcement is that he has written a views plugin that lets you select form fields in a view the same way that you could select data fields. And you say, okay, well, that sounds really cool, but what can I do with it? The immediate example he gives is doing something with views bulk operations. Right now, views bulk operations basically does some magic so that when it selects all of the different rows in the table, it puts a checkbox at the beginning of each row. What he does here is he puts the checkbox on the other side of the table just to prove that it can be done, and then he proceeds to actually go through some views bulk operations, you know, well, the operations part of it, right? The actions.
Mm-hmm.
And then he walks into a module that I guess exists for Drupal 6 that's called editable fields for CCK, and, you know, how that might be able to be worked in here. So some of this is like theoretical, but this is the whole like edit in place thing is something that I've been waiting for a while. And it's inevitably it comes up in the course of some project. Well, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could just push a button and have everything edit, and we've got the overlay now, which is really, really nice because it doesn't make your brain have to change that context of, oh, I'm in admin now, and then where was I just before? And like, yeah. I think the idea of this gets us a lot closer to that. And then in the end of the video, he goes in a little bit about some of the cool integrations between rules and views bulk operations. And I don't know how much that has to do with the form fields thing, but I guess he was already on views bulk operations, so let's just keep going with that.
So is this basically a way of, and I'm sure this is not a word, but it might be a new word in a second, genericizing, like, views bulk operations, kind of making
right.
it?
Right. Right, right now, oh. It is a very special purpose module, and you can only kind of do views bulk operations with views bulk operations, but you might be able to, yeah, make another module that does similar things without having to install that specific module, because now we've got this ability to pull out form fields with views. And he says it's part of Vue's core as well. So apparently, right. If you go download the latest dev version of Vue's, don't quote me on that, but I think that's what he's saying,
yeah.
That it's in there already.
So it sounds like with this, you could probably do some slick thing like, you know, list a, or have Vue's output a table along with maybe a form element for each cell in the table that lets you type in new data.
And that's that editable fields module that he's
talking about. Yeah, that's what I was getting to, yeah.
So in theory, because this is something that I have seen as a really big detractor to Drupal right now. Here's a very real-world example. doing a website for a TV station. And right now, the person who programs the TV station puts all of the TV shows and their show times for the week in a spreadsheet and then bakes them down to a CSV, and we import it into the Drupal site, or at least that's the plan, because it's so much faster to edit a spreadsheet of, you know, 30 rows and how many time slots, and then click on a node edit page, click on the field, type in the value, push save, go again, go again, go again. So this might be able to, you know, remove the need for that and speed up his workflow.
Matt, have you seen that? Have you played with this or seen this, Matt?
No, I haven't.
All right, next topic.
I want to, though.
I'm just kidding.
Just for the sake of the flow, I'm going to jump us ahead to the next story on our document here. Really related to this is a post by CHX, who a lot of people may know as... Well, we've actually already referenced him in this podcast. Maybe Chex needs his own drinking name, too.
He might. He might. Because I don't think anyone's had a drink yet, because we haven't said someone else's name.
So
it's our first dry podcast.
He made this post this week about possibly trying to look at this new WYSIWYG editor out there called Aloha as a possible candidate for incorporating a WYSIWYG editor into Drupal core. And whether or not it actually happens, it's a great discussion to have. And especially now that HTML5 technologies are coming online and a lot more browsers are supporting them, it's just a good time to take a look at some of these new snappy things that we've got out there.
And Aloha is so pretty.
It is very nice. It's basically it's an in-place editor. Like the examples they have, if you go to their try it section of the aloha-editor.org, they've got a couple different examples, and it's got this like floating toolbar with tabs and like pretty previews, and it looks kind of like a little edit-in-place editor. It's really nice.
Almost lickable.
one of the comments on Chex's post actually says, you know, this won't work on older versions of Internet Explorer, and by older now everyone's talking about anything less than 9. Is an older version. So, you know, there's going to be some issues. This may not be able to be included in Drupal 8 by default, like turned on by default, but it's still really pretty. And I look forward to the day when this is incorporated into the WYSIWYG module because I want to try it.
There you go.
So that's those two editing in place stories I thought went together. So Mike, you have the last story today.
Yeah, so last story is straw poll for DrupalCon North America 2013, so 2 years from now, for the location of DrupalCon North America. And basically they did this, I would say about this time last year, in helping them to decide on Denver for DrupalCon 2012, and the time has come for kind of a new straw poll, and this is not something where the majority wins and DrupalCon will definitely be in the city that gets the most votes. It's just kind of one of the aspects that the selection committee takes into account. But it's always interesting to see which cities are on the straw poll. There's always an option to kind of do a write-in. And of course, since I've already taken the survey, I'm now realizing I can't see the I can't see the options.
I will give you the rundown, Mike.
Okay, give us. Yeah. So, which cities are actually listed there for potential?
Well, one thing that makes me sad is I remember last time they did this, Miami was on the list, and it's not there this time.
Yes.
You know, for us, we live in Florida, and it would just be a quick drive, opposed to pretty much everything else on this list. Portland, Oregon. Austin, Texas, which basically means get a camper and hang out in March in Austin. Washington, D.C., that was a good place for DrupalCon. San Francisco, obviously great. Montreal, I would love to go there. Los Angeles, thumbs down for me. San Diego, very good.
Did you just alienate all of our listeners in Los Angeles?
I just don't like going to conferences in Los Angeles.
I, for one, think Los Angeles is the best city in the country.
Well, good. This
and I'm saying that to keep our listeners happy.
Each other. So what, Los Angeles, San Diego, New York City would be very fun, but I don't know exactly where the convention centers are there. I guess they must have some. Seattle, Washington, Boston, Massachusetts. So some of these are places where we've already had a DrupalCon, and I know that sometimes these big conferences, they just sort of rotate between four or five cities every couple of years. Mm. They find the few that work for them, and maybe they even just do like one East Coast, one West Coast, and alternate back and forth there. But I know that the Canadians would love to see something in Canada. Yeah. And right now, the only thing on the short list is Montreal.
I love these type of surveys because they actually ask you to rank them 1 to 10. Mm-hmm. Like, where do you want to see it the most? So let's ask Matt. Matt, out of those cities, I don't know if you have the survey in front of you, but give us like your top three, just out of curiosity.
Oh, I'd go Montreal, and then probably Portland, Oregon, and then probably Seattle.
All right. How about you, Ryan?
Mine's pretty close to that. I might be interested in Austin just because, like I said, you could, depending on what time of year it is, you could go to DrupalCon in South by Southwest, you know, and you wouldn't even have to leave. You could just grab a place downtown. So I'm going to say Montreal, Seattle, and Austin, Texas.
You know what's weird about this is my first choice is Montreal as well. So I wonder if there's like some actual momentum there, if that's just a coincidence on our part. But I would go...
Three out of three hosts of the Drupal Easy podcast agree.
Yeah, and actually, Matt and I have the same first two. Montreal, Portland. But I would go San Diego for the third one. I think
You're a little biased, aren't you, Mike?
I like, you know, I have family there. It's, you know, it's a cool city, so... But
honestly, San Diego in March is probably going to be a lot nicer than Seattle and Portland.
Yeah, that's true. But I think we're still young enough where I don't think we need to start repeating cities again. So I think when I did the survey, I had Boston, D.C., what else? San Francisco. I had those down near the bottom, not because they're not cool places to have conferences, but, you know, let's go somewhere different. But anyway,
so, I would love to know from the international perspective, like what different cities they choose, the people who don't live in the U.S. or in North America versus everyone else.
Yeah, do they go with the biggest airports or the most tourist-friendly destinations or what?
Yeah, it could be one of those things where a lot of, you know, I'm talking out the out of my gamma quadrant here, but a lot of people living in the U.S. have been to, like, not a lot, but relatively speaking, you know, in the Drupal community, have probably been to New York or L.A. or some of the bigger cities, where someone outside of the U.S. who has never been to the U.S. or has never been to New York City, I would probably want to go to New York City as well. I mean, New York City is not in my top four or five only because I've been there a lot. And I, you know, I kind of like to go to places where I haven't been before. So,
well, and Mike, you also grew up in New England, right?
So I grew up in New England, yeah. So
you probably got to go to New York all the time. And if you grew up in the Southeast, you go to Atlanta all the time. So it's just little things like that. You're the biggest magnet city near you. You're going to be like, eh,
right. So kind of along with the story as well, there's they also announced who's actually on the selection committee. And it's names that we've all heard before. A lot of them are actually hardcore developers. I'm going to run through them quickly. We don't need to, you know, Jeff Eaton, who we know is with Lullabot and just is a huge Drupal brain. Betsy Ensley, I'm not familiar with her. Tiffany Ferris, who was one of the organizers for DrupalCon Chicago. Emma Jane Hogbin, who's a theming guru. Neil Kent, who's a DrupalCon events manager. Greg Knadison, our buddy at GVS and Certified to Rock. Jen Lampton from Chapter 3, I believe. Is that right? I hope that's right.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, out in San Francisco is another trainer. And Carrie Gordon and Jacob Redding, who are Carrie's been running the some of the Drupal cons for a few years, and Jacob is actually one of the employees of the Drupal Association. So it's just... I love the way...
I think I can fill in your blank there. Okay. Betsy, I believe, is the person who put together DrupalCon DC.
Oh, okay, great. All right. But I love the way all of this is so open. You know, there's a great post on the Drupal Association website, link will be in the show notes, about what are they going to consider? You know, who's on the committee? You know, what exactly are they going to do? What's the process? And I think, you know... as with everything else in the Drupal community, the more transparent it is, the better. And, you know, so I'm fascinated by this stuff. So that's why it's a story on the podcast.
And you have about 2 more weeks, not even, to vote. So get out there and show, you know, tell them what you're interested in.
Right. It's
now that we've told you who to vote for, yes. Go out there and make it happen.
Vote for Montreal. That's really the message that we want to give you here.
June 19th, right? That's the last date. Let's see, through June 19th at 11:59 p.m. Hawaiian Standard Time.
Well, that's the last time zone, right? That's when that day stops. Is that true?
There might be people in the Aleutian Islands who will take umbrage with that statement, but I don't know anybody. I don't know if that's the same time zone or not. You know, although if like Anchorage or Honolulu was on the DrupalCon straw poll, I think my top one might be a little bit different, but. Anyway,
Anchorage in March.
That sounds awesome, doesn't it? We can all get mucklucks and go cross country skiing.
Very good, very good. Mike, do we have a message from our friends at WebEnable today?
You know, I don't have anything specific to say other than webenable.com, and you know, we use them for all of our development sites with all of our clients. They have Git and SVN hosting. We're now fully invested with their Git hosting. It's going pretty smoothly so far. It's great for small, you know, Drupal organizations like ours, where we have a number of developers. We want to have one dev site where everyone can kind of push their code up to and everybody can see.
Well, it really is kind of a kitchen sink.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one thing that if you looked at WebEnabled from the outside, they don't necessarily have like a bug tracker or anything, but they've got several bug trackers as the applications that you could install.
Yeah.
So you could eat your own dog food with the web-enabled development environment. They give you two to start. So you could have one be your dev site and one be your bug tracker site. Each time you install a new application, they kind of treat that as a new site, a new subdomain, a web-enabled. And it's really great.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, for the smallest of Drupal shops, for, you know, if you're one or one or two people working on a project together, it's always great to have a dev server somewhere that not only the developer, you and your other developer can see, but also the client can take a look at. And it's on a server that you don't have to maintain. You know, it's fantastic that way. It saves a lot of time. And
they have the push button deployment to several other major hosting providers. Right. They provide hosting, but they also will integrate with other people's products. So definitely webenable.com. They provide us with free stuff, and then we give them a shout out on the podcast.
Shout out. Here you go.
So the next portion of our podcast is always the picks of the week. Every week, one of our hosts will select a module or a blog post, it seems lately with Mike, that they have been inspired by recently or something that's really saved their Drupal keister. So, Mike, what is your pick of the week?
Yeah, I am on a streak, like a non-module streak lately. I actually felt really guilty about this pick, but I kind of went through, you know, I bookmarked things all, you know, for in between podcasts, and I didn't really have a new module that I'd started using in the past 2 weeks. And I like to use it a little bit, at least, before I mention it on the podcast. But this blog post by Seth Brown from Lullabot called The Art of Estimation was one of those blog posts that just kind of stuck with me. And as I was thinking about my pick of the week, I'm like, well, this is kind of obvious because I've been thinking about it a lot, and I think a lot of people can probably get a lot out of it. When you are talking to a client and they are telling you, you know, they're asking you, what's it going to take to, you know, build this out? You know, give me an estimate. Here's what I want. No, that process, the bigger the site, the harder that process is. And there's a couple different ways of doing it. We've been using Civic Actions open sourced their estimating worksheet a couple years ago. And that's what we tweet a little bit with some custom stuff. And we've been using that fairly successfully. But Lullabot recently released their estimating worksheet. And it's very different than Civic Actions, which is great because I love to see opposing ways of doing the same thing because it makes me think. But it's a really great walkthrough of how do you talk to a client? What questions did you ask them? How do you break down what they're asking in order to give them an estimate that, you know, is somewhere in the neighborhood of reality? So anybody who has to come up with estimates for clients, this is definitely an article you should read, specifically because it's Drupal-centric. And it does talk about, you know, estimating, you know, break tasks down into content types, into views, into things like that, that's one way of doing it. So I definitely encourage people involved in any part of the project management process to check out this article. It, you know, I know it's helped me, and we may or may not adopt some of the things I talked about here.
Yes, I thought that was a great article, and Seth's method is probably close to what we used at Palantir too, and with the emphasis on, you know, think about it the Drupal way. Think about views and nodes and content types and stuff. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, which sometimes, like, you don't want to do. You know, I've read articles that aren't Drupal specific that say the exact opposite, where spec out the project and estimate it based on just purely on a user story that doesn't get into the technical details. So this article has, it's a nice, it's a very different look at that type of thing. And I should mention, I just listened to the Drupal Voices number 191. I don't know when it was released. It was probably released a month or two ago, but I actually just got to it a day or two ago, and it's actually Kent Bai, who I can't say enough good things about the Drupal Voices podcast that he does. I love it. But he interviewed Seth Brown about almost the exact same topic. So it's kind of a blog post and then an audio interview about the same topic. So they kind of go hand in hand. It's really, you know, for anyone doing project management stuff, it's almost a must read and a must listen to, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and the thing that I really liked about that Drupal Voices is how Seth talks about the way that, you know, not only do they go about estimating a project, and a lot of that, well, you just listen to the podcast. Let's go through. Let's just give that a short version.
And Kent, I feel like Kent's like the quiet.
He's my hero.
Well, he's like the quiet lullaby. You don't hear him, you know. But the stuff he does is fantastic. So, shout out to Kent.
That's my pick of the week is Kent Bai. No. He actually is by a lullaby, though, coincidentally. It is called Eva, and that's my best attempt at Wally. Eva, it's short for Entity Views Attachment. And this is a module that's Drupal 7 only. The entity might give that away. The basic idea being that you used to have all these kind of weird things in Drupal 6 where you could do a views attached to a node, or you could have a view as a field, or you could, you know, put views in all these interesting places. But now we don't just have nodes anymore, we have entities. So think, I could attach a view to a taxonomy term. I could attach a view to a user. I could attach a view to a comment. I could attach a view to, what else is an entity?
User, comment, file, node.
A file, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, somebody who wrote a book on this, maybe he would know.
I'm sorry, I jumped in too fast. Maybe, you know what, maybe Matt didn't know. That's why. No.
And there are new modules that create new entities too. So, like, I think the Drupal Commerce creates a number of entities, right?
Yeah.
As an example. So the idea being, you can attach a view to these entities, and then you can use the entity's ID as a contextual filter. I'm going to have to get used to saying that instead of argument, to sort of drive the display of it. That's the short version. It's still in development, but maybe worth your time to check out.
Yeah, and this is actually, this is the successor to the Views Attached module.
Right. I'm going to set up a Drupal 7 site. I'm going into my toolkit of, like, regularly used modules, and I say Views Attached, and I go to the module page, and it says, this module doesn't exist for Drupal 7, but go look over here.
Yeah, use Eva. So, yeah, I didn't know about this. This is great. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of the natural evolution of Views Attached. It makes... As soon as I read the first paragraph on the document of the module description here, why wouldn't this module exist?
All right, and Matt, have you got a pick for us this week?
Oh yeah, there are a couple things. One is that, you know, as I start paying more attention to what's going on in Drupal 8, I know that HeyRocker has been really working hard to kickstart the configuration in Drupal 8 stuff. And this last week, that group has been pretty active, or he's been pretty active on that group, kind of giving hints and teasers about directions that he thinks things could go. And he's done a lot of work, and many people have done a lot of work kind of analyzing how other projects are doing configuration management and serializing that kind of data. And so that's kind of an exciting thing to me, because it's an area where you can still have some influence on Drupal 8. And that particular group, I think, is really good about soliciting feedback. So I've been following that and watching how it's going. The second one is a jQuery plugin that I discovered, or that Matt Farina actually told me about, courtesy of Nathan Smith, the 960WS guy, that saved my butt. And that was the data tables plugin for jQuery. And it's awesome. So my problem was, I had this gigantic table, right, an HTML table, and I really wanted to be able to add a bunch of just UI features to it. I wanted to be able to page through the table. I wanted to be able to search for data inside the table. I wanted it to be nice and fast and responsive and all of that. And I had about 2 hours to do this, of course. And this data tables jQuery plugin, you basically slap it on top of your existing HTML table, and it turns it into a nice paged searchable table.
It is so pretty.
Yeah, it is. And you can use any of the jQuery UI theme roller themes. So you can change the skin on it, you know, with a line of JavaScript or uncommenting a CSS file. And so it was great. I mean, you know, I produced this 500 line table off the back end, and then just popped it in this 500 row table, popped it in the jQuery thing, and it looked like I'd spent 15 hours on it, and it was great.
It looks like it even has like a little fast search there.
Yeah, which was awesome, because I was dumping out log files and trying to find kind of common log messages, so I could just type something in the search field and have it narrow it down to 10 rows that looked like what I was searching for.
Oh, that is great. It is fast. Wow, that is slick.
Yeah.
The link will be in the show notes, datatables.net. Wow.
All right, we're just going to let you keep rolling with these picks, Matt, because you've got a lot of cool stuff to point to this week.
Yeah, well, yeah. And the other thing that, of course, has been big news is Google and Yahoo and Microsoft have unveiled schema.org, which is yet another HTML metadata markup thing. And
which one is this? Is it microdata or RDFA?
Well, it's their own spin on microdata, but they seem to have ignored the existing microdata formats that are out there. And they, as far as I understand it, they basically wanted to start with the microdata-ish support that was introduced in HTML5, and sort of, I'm going to use the F word, they were talking about forking it and basically making their own, or that's what they proposed, is kind of their own microdata format. And the frustrating part about it is, you know, Drupal 7 now has RDFA support, and, you know, I've worked on several projects now that have been moving aggressively toward RDFA because it looked like the standard. And then you get the big guns, you know, Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft saying, yeah, we don't think RDFA is the right way to go. Here's our brand new standard.
Yeah, when I first went to the schema.org site, it wasn't very clear. Like, it said that the search engines were going to support this, but it wasn't very clear who put out the site and whether or not you should start using this now, or if it was just kind of there just for looking at. Like,
yeah, and I think that it was kind of announced on Friday of last week that Google and Microsoft and Yahoo were the big supporters. And it's somewhere on that schema.org site. And then over the weekend, there's been some interesting developments in the case. Manu, I think his last name is Sporny, who's one of the main RDFA contributors, has kind of fired back at schema.org. And gave a good criticism of basically how he sees this as a sort of strong arming by the big search engine giants to say, okay, we want you to do things this way, after telling you that you could have done things all of these other ways, and after apparently supporting all these other formats, now we're just going to switch it right now. And the whole site is kind of worded in such a way that it insinuates that you'll do better SEO wise if you follow those standards as opposed to those de facto standards as opposed to RDFA and some of the others.
Yeah, that's a pretty strong blog post that Manu wrote.
He doesn't pull any punches does he?
Not at all.
And so it's an interesting debate to watch. And Drupal has this remarkable SEO affinity. I mean, a lot of us develop Drupal sites and never spend any time doing more than cursory SEO, and Drupal sites just do well. And a lot of that is because of the effort, you know, theme developers have made in keeping the markup pretty semantic, and that people have made on introducing RDFA and other methods of embedding metadata inside of Drupal. So anytime I see something like this, I think, well, what exactly is this going to mean for Drupal, and how's the community going to react to yet another special way of doing your markup? So,
all right, since you're a guest, we're going to give you like 17 more picks of the week, so let's keep going. I think you have one more in here, right?
Yeah, the last one is the Google Plus One button. And there are so many things I want to say about this, but none of them are really nice. So it's interesting to see Google going after Facebook again. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of discouraging to see. Oh, so for anyone who doesn't know, that little Facebook like button that's plaguing the internet, well, Google has one now that's the Google Plus One button. So anytime you like a page you're viewing or an article you're reading, you can click that Google Plus One button, and it will plus one it in the vast Google data center array of information about the web. And as I understand it, when other readers come and visit the site, they'll see this post was plus one by your friend Matt Butcher and 200 others or something like that. And it's I just find it interesting to see the direction of the Google being influenced so much by Facebook, but also kind of discouraged at what to me at least superficially appears to be kind of a lack of innovation in introducing yet another feature.
Yeah, it's really very copycat-ish. You know, it's very. Yeah, I was surprised by it as well. You know, Google's kind of always done things their own little spin on it, so to speak, but there's not a whole lot of spin here.
Yeah. But then over the weekend, I caught something on some random TV show as I was channel flipping, and if I had known that I was going to say this out loud, I would have actually written down what I was watching and who was saying it. But it was a couple of social media types talking about the struggle that marketing organizations are having understanding this idea of small communities on the web that people are forming through Facebook, these little short 4 and 5, well, 100 or less groups of friends on Facebook and such. Mm-hmm. And are we still on?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're good.
I just saw
this. Is Ryan still there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Sorry. It got really quiet from the sound.
We're enthralled.
And and I guess, the web has been driven for so long by the attempt to reach so many people with the same message that now so many of these larger organizations are trying to react to the fact that Facebook-y style communities and Twitter style, I guess you'd call them communities, where, as they put it on the show, a housewife and her 100 followers suddenly start having some kind of buying or purchasing influence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and I started rethinking the Google Plus One button and thinking, oh, I'm starting to suspect that Google sees this as a first step for them to leverage or get a foothold into that kind of approach. And again, from a Drupal perspective, it's very interesting to me because Drupal has been a social media tool for so long now, building these small communities. and it'll be interesting to see how Drupal co-evolves with this kind of, I don't know, I guess insurgents by Google and Facebook and some of these other places who are trying to steal our small communities from us. No, trying to figure out how to work together with these small communities that are forming around them.
Right, and you know, I guess the question is, so what is the incentive for sites to put this plus one stuff on their site? Like, what's in it for them?
And, yeah, and that's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, the obvious answer is, you know, there's probably going to be somewhere that you could see, oh, your friend, you know, your friend Matt just plus one this article. You should go check it out.
Yeah, actually, if you have this feature turned on, when you pull up a list of Google search results, right below the result it will say, your friend Michael Anello gave this story a plus one.
Okay.
So it's sort of like it will show up in Google, from what I understand. And you can already see some of this if your friend, you know, made a Twitter post about this article.
Right.
So this is just sort of like an extension of that, but Google's storing it in their own database instead of somebody else's.
Right.
Yeah, cool. So it'll be an interesting way of driving traffic for people like ConsumerSearch.com, where I work. We're interested in technologies like that as an interesting way of bringing new traffic into the site conveniently. So,
part of About.com, a New York Times company.
That's right.
Very good.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan.
Week. I still had 7 more, but I can't fill them. Sorry.
Mike, are we skipping site of the week this week?
I think
there was recently a post on Dries' blog about Chris Rock.
There you go. That's the site of the week.
Chris Rock. That is a Drupal site. So if you want, go check that out on Dries' blog. But we're going to try to keep this short.
Not too late.
Mike's got a dinner date with his family. So I'm just going to give the little sign-off. Our guest this week has been Matt Butcher, who you can find at TechnoSophos, TechnoSophos. And you can find us, Drupal Easy, on Twitter, on Facebook, on the iTunes Store, on the friend feed. On if you go to Delicious, we use a tag Drupal Easy Podcast to sort of like call up some stories for the week.
Don't forget the book.
Please do check out Matt, the book that Matt co-authored with all those other fantastic Drupalers, Drupal 7 Module Development by Pact Publishing. We have been the Drupal Easy Podcast. Ulta Mike, Mr. Michael Anello.
Sorry.
I have been Ryan Price, a.k.a. Liberator. And thanks once again to our sponsor, Web Enabled. We'll see you next week, Mike. What else do we have to say?
See ya!